And I woke up in that hospital the following day feeling the deepest amount of gratitude I've ever felt for the fact that I am still here, still alive. And then the second word that came to me was opportunity. What was the opportunity in what happened to me? And what is the opportunity of what happened to America and the world in this great recession of 2008?
Welcome back to another episode of How Are You Helping? The podcast that brings to you notable leaders of purpose-driven organizations who share the mindsets, attitudes, and beliefs that got them focused on living a compassionate, altruistic life or career. I'm your host, Sean Riley. Welcome back and thanks for tuning in to another episode of How Are You Helping? According to a study by Porter Novelli, 83% of millennials say it's important for companies they buy from to align with their beliefs and values, and these numbers are even higher for Generation Z, people born from 1995 to 2010. In fact, one-third of all consumers today will stop buying their preferred products if they lose trust in the brand, according to a study by IBM. This means that to be sustainable and successful, organizations have to become more conscious and more flexible in their approach. How do companies take an expanded view of their stakeholders and define mission statements that succeed in today's shifting economy? What does it take for an organization to succeed and be sustainable over time? And how does one find opportunity amidst major life disruptions like the pandemic, which has taken a major toll on the economy and small businesses? Today, I'm very pleased to introduce to you Mark Monchek, who is an expert on sustainable company growth through conscious business with the organization he founded, the Opportunity Lab, a strategy consulting firm which empowers leaders focused on conscious and sustainable growth. We'll be back in just a moment. In lieu of sponsorships or ads, today I'd like to request that you donate to our podcast via the listener support link in the show notes. However, instead of going towards new equipment or expenses, your listener support donation will go directly to a couple of organizations helping causes near and dear to me. By financially supporting How Are You Helping from now until December 31st, your donation will be directly split between the following three causes. The first one is to help the victims of the wildfires burning in Oregon, Washington, California, and Idaho. As unprecedented fires swept across the West Coast this year, over 5 million acres catastrophically burned. To help communities recover, the first part of your donation will go directly towards organizations working on the ground to provide support and relief to these communities. The next part of the donation will be used to help victims of the devastating explosion in Beirut, Lebanon. The donations will specifically go toward helping provide food and essential health care to elderly citizens. Finally, the third organization we are supporting is helping provide relief on the ground in the Philippines as they grapple with Typhoons Goni and Vamco, which have caused severe flooding and affected over 1.6 million people. We know times are tough on a lot of people, but if you're feeling generous and are financially able, I highly encourage you to help support our show by donating to listener support and help us make a direct impact on the communities that need it most. Now, back to the show. Mark is the author of the Amazon bestseller, Culture of Opportunity, How to Grow Your Business in an Age of Disruption, and he has worked with leaders from Google, Apple, Columbia University, Warby Parker, the United Nations, General Electric, NBC, the New York Times, and others. Mark has also been featured in Real Leaders Magazine, the Lifetime Network, Conscious Talk Radio, Newsday, the San Francisco Chronicle, and various other media publications and interviews. He's going to talk about some of the greatest lessons he's learned from his multi-decade-long career, which includes helping businesses recover from disruptions like the 9/11 tragedy, the 2008 recession, and how his strategy consulting firm, the Opportunity Lab, came to be, where he coaches clients to build a culture of opportunity. He has spent the majority of his career serving others and helping conscious businesses grow sustainably, and is involved with many charities and causes as well. So it is my incredible pleasure and honor of introducing to you today, Mark Monchek. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Sean. It's wonderful to be with you. I love your show and listen to a number of episodes, and it's great the work that you're doing in the world. So we're kindred spirits here on this quest for a better world.
Wonderful. Awesome. And it's an honor to have you here today. I wanted to start off the interview asking about some of the work that you do empowering conscious leaders to make a difference in the world, some of the fundamental concepts from your book, The Culture of Opportunity, and then we'll dive into the personal layers behind the meaningful work that you're doing throughout your life and your career. Then we'll do a round of rapid-fire questions to close off the show and finish up the interview shortly after that. Does that sound good?
Sounds great to me, Sean. Thank you.
First, I want to ask, what are some of the trends that you've been seeing that have helped businesses survive during this pandemic?
Well, we've been coaching, consulting companies as the Opportunity Lab for 10 years, and before that, probably for almost 40 years. So when the pandemic hit, we immediately understood that this was all about helping employees and customers feel safe, feel cared about, and adapting to a totally new way of working. So we helped one of our largest clients, a consumer electronics retailer here based in New York, but actually has a national and international presence, move 75% of their employees to work remotely in their homes within the course of a week. Now, this was a company that in the past had not been very comfortable with remote work, really preferred their people to work in the office in a very structured way. But they understood very quickly that this had to change radically, and all the employees understood this as well. And this was really a case study about trust between employer and employee. And the employer basically said that we trust you and we want to do everything we can to help support you, not just in your life and business, but understanding that people have children, have parents, people have had people who have died during this period, have gotten sick. So there was a tremendous flexibility and responsiveness, both on the part of the company and the part of their employees, to be able to realize we're in this together. We are absolutely interdependent. No one can survive without understanding there's an interdependence between employer and employee, between stockholders and companies, between customers. It's a radical shift. I think that's one of the biggest trends, is really understanding the interdependence of all living things in the world, and in particularly in business, the different stakeholders within an ecosystem of a company.
Wonderful. We'll definitely dive into some of those mindsets and strategies that you coach business leaders on in a few moments. I first wanted to ask, what is the Share Lab? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So we developed Share Lab right at the end of March of this year because we understood that in order to keep employees connected to each other, connected to their employer, and connected to their customers, we had to wait to gather people together since they were not able to meet in a physical place, and everybody was traumatized in a variety of different ways. So the Share Lab is essentially a meeting of a department where we come together for an hour or so, and we ask people three fundamental questions in the first Share Lab. One is, where are you calling from? So we can root people in their physical location, letting people know where they are living and how they're doing about, you know, where they're living. Second question is, what is inspiring you and what is troubling you? So those are the first three questions we ask to help people get grounded. And then we go through that those three questions with every single employee in that particular department. And we honor their feelings. We ask questions. There's some ways that people actually can help each other, because there's a lot of sharing that goes on of ways people are coping with the pandemic. And at the very end, we ask, okay, so now that we've heard from everybody, what can we as a company do that we're not already doing to help you manage better? And is there anything anybody wants to offer somebody else to help them with what they've learned in managing it through this pandemic?
Wow.
So we've done Share Labs with a number of our clients through all of the different departments, and the questions will change over time. But essentially, it's a format to hold space for employees sharing their feelings, their questions, their concerns, and what they need help with, and the company offering information as well as support and guidance to make sure that everybody feels cared about and understands what we can do as a company to help them, and what each person can do to help their colleagues.
Wow, that sounds phenomenal, Mark. I was wondering, what are some of the prerequisites for getting involved with ShareLab and taking advantage of some of those mentorship opportunities?
Well, our clients hire us to implement ShareLab within their company, and then we train their HR staff, their human resources staff, or other staff to be able to implement ShareLab in the way that, you know, we train them to do it. So if a company is interested in implementing ShareLab, they can contact one of my staff at discover@oplab.com, or they can go to our website and use the contact form, and then we can talk to them about, you know, how ShareLab might work in their company.
Awesome. That sounds fantastic. And now I do want to ask you about the Opportunity Lab. When did you realize that you wanted to create the Opportunity Lab, and what were you going through at the time? What led you to start this organization? And can you bring me back to where you were in 2007, pre-recession, and then talk about what took place after that? How did the recession impact your business career and your entrepreneurship journey?
Yeah, Sean, that's a pivotal year for my previous company, which is called Perform Excellence. We had our best year ever in 2007, and I was traveling around the country. We had a significant number of clients, large revenue, and I had gotten so caught up in the status, in the ego of it, you know, in feeling like, yeah, you know, we're doing good with all these clients, and we were, but I didn't realize how attached I was to the status and the gratification of what I, you know, what I felt I was in the world. I went to India in December of 2007. And I went on a three-week, what's called a yatra, or a spiritual pilgrimage, to the holiest sites in India, you know, from New Delhi to Rishikesh to Vrindavan to Varanasi, which is the holiest city in India, Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha found enlightenment, all the way, you know, down to Tamil Nadu and Mount Arunachala, and then all the way west to Goa. And we went into temples, we went into ashrams, we actually bathed in the Ganges River. And I saw the most extreme poverty that I had ever seen in my life. But in that moment, I saw people who looked into my eyes I'd never seen before and would never see again. And I saw the love and the warmth and the connectedness that I had never even seen in any of my relationships in a high-rise building that I had lived in Riverdale for 14 years. So I came back really kind of opened up, feeling the beautiful power of the Indian people and the country. You know, it's the birthplace of Buddhism, the birthplace of Hinduism, Jainism, Zoroastrianism. There's 250 million Muslims that live in there, the third largest Islamic population in the world.
Right.
Came back, and 3 weeks after I came back in January of 2008, I realized that my office manager had stolen a significant amount of money, a six-figure amount of money from our company. Cracked open, wide open, with this kind of spiritual awakening, it kind of hit me with this devastating sense of betrayal, and it sent me into a very stark depression just at the same time that the American economy was going into its stark recession. And every day I would wake up in the morning and I would see, you know, 5,000 more people laid off, company going out of business, stock market plummeting. And my depression just got worse and worse. Tried all kinds of different therapies, tried all kinds of different medications. Ended up in a hospital to get the treatment I finally wound up needing. And I woke up in that hospital the following day feeling the deepest amount of gratitude I've ever felt for the fact that I am still here, still alive. And then the second word that came to me was opportunity. What was the opportunity in what happened to me? And what is the opportunity of what happened to America and the world in this great recession of 2008? So I began to see the difference between companies that were surviving and thriving in this terrific, terribly recession and those that were actually going out of business or dropping to become a fraction of what they formerly were.
Right.
And you can think about those companies now in retrospect. So you have companies like Blockbuster, which was the number one, you know, video rental company in the world. They were just on top of the world, but they didn't see streaming coming. Netflix actually, they could have bought Netflix when Netflix was in its infancy. They chose not to. They just were in denial about it.
Wow.
Nokia was the largest maker of handsets in the world, the largest cell phone maker in the world, little Finnish company. They didn't see the internet. They didn't see the smartphone. They didn't see what they had to do to their technology. Now they are actually a virtual digital mapping company, and they're a tiny fraction of what they were. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, bloated, unresilient, you know, they tanked. Lehman Brothers, I guess, Bear Stearns actually did survive, but, you know, as a fraction. These banks, Washington Mutual, insurance company AIG, all of these large companies that did not have a way to adapt to these changes. Then you see companies that were born around this time. Netflix, Etsy, Airbnb, Uber, you know.
I think you mentioned you worked with Warby Parker. Is that one of them?
Warby Parker was definitely one of them that started around this time. Facebook was only 4 years old in 2008. We forget that. We think Facebook's been around forever. So you see the companies like Facebook, Google, like Apple, that, you know, they've been around, but they actually got bigger and stronger. And these other companies, they've been around for much, much longer, got weaker. Some of them actually died. You remember Research in Motion, the maker of the BlackBerry? They were extremely dominant company. They had the largest number of business smartphones in the world, and they couldn't adapt. Yahoo was a major player in the internet. Now they are a small fraction of that. So what we learned is that companies must adapt to disruptions, and companies that are not set up for that, do not have a culture of opportunity, when a disruption happens, they'll often get caught short. And we're seeing that now in the pandemic, that companies that had bet on a certain form of business and cannot adapt are struggling. And those companies that are more versatile and more resilient, like our particular client that I mentioned, Adorama is the name of the company, they have been rising and getting even stronger.
Wow. Mark, that's a terrific story of how you kind of came back from India and took all this knowledge, this information, and went through such adversity and had that theft from your business, and then translated that into looking at trends of major businesses and how you can be coaching and developing companies through the midst of all of that. So I really am inspired by that story. It's amazing. And I just dove into your book, Culture of Opportunity, and I think that this is some invaluable advice that is really going to serve our audience today. I really wanted to ask you, what are some of the exciting developments that you're seeing at the Opportunity Lab? And can you tell me more about what's going on there?
Yeah, well, the Share Lab is a program I said that we started at the end of March of this year. And we're starting to train other companies as how to use the Share Lab program themselves. So that's been very exciting. We created another program called Opportunity Community, which is a community of business leaders, entrepreneurs, artists, social activists who want to be connected through this pandemic. So we've got that been running since early April, and we've seen an amazing amount of support that's come from this group. And people have launched new businesses, people have grown their businesses, and people actually feel so emotionally connected to their colleagues in ways that they never had before. And people had never met any of these folks. Well, these are people that I gathered that are my colleagues. We gather together every 2 weeks. It's a format of an hour and a half. It's kind of similar to Share Lab. You know, we have a different format every couple of weeks. So last Thursday, we did what's called the Untold Story, where every member of Opportunity Community was asked to bring a personal story from their life of 5 minutes or less. And Sean, it was so powerful. People who had just getting to know each other through Opportunity Community got to know each other on a deeper level by sharing personal stories. It's quite amazing how you might know somebody for many, many years. You know where they live, you might know their family, you know their job title. But until you hear a personal story, a story that's shaped who they are, you don't really get to know who they are. And a lot of our interactions are so superficial, where we ask questions that don't dive deep into who the person is. What's their character? How did they get to be who they are? So the Untold Story, which is part of our Opportunity Community, was incredibly powerful in connecting people on a deeper level. And we ask a lot of the same questions that we ask in Share Lab in Opportunity Community. What's inspiring you? What's troubling you? What do you most learn these last couple of weeks? What is your unique greatness? How do you use that unique greatness in the world? What are the obstacles that are holding you back? So there's a lot of personal development and conscious business growth that happens in both ShareLab and Opportunity Community.
That's fantastic. That sounds really interesting. I really wanted to ask about the concepts in your book, Culture of Opportunity. What are some of the major lessons or themes in the book?
So as I was mentioning before, Sean, what we learned in the 2008 recession is that companies need to be resilient and adaptive and be able to face whatever disruption happens so they can grow in any economy. And the first thing that we do in Culture of Opportunity is define, so what are you going to measure yourself by? What does success look like in your company? So we ask our clients to define up to 5 measures of success. So obviously sales is one and profit is another, but what are the 3 other measures that will define whether your company is successful or not? Could it be maybe customer experience, customer retention, employee retention, employee experience? Is it innovation, technological innovation or other kinds of innovation? What are the things that are going to keep you growing in any economy in addition to being profitable and having sales? So defining what are the measures of success or what are the business results that you're already committed to, step number one. Step number two is assembling what we call an opportunity team, which are people both inside the company and outside the company. And it's really critical, Sean, that every company has an outside set of voices that are challenging the status quo. This is what these companies that either went out of business or went terribly down did not have. They did not have voices challenging the status quo. So our opportunity team are a group of people, anywhere from 6 to 10 people, who are strategic thinkers, who have unique skill sets that complement one another, that are willing to be open and willing to continually ask, what can we do better? How can we do it better? And at least half of them are going to be outside the company. They could be customers, they could be investors, they could be university professors, they could be consultants, but people who are not working in the company and they don't have a stake in the company, so they're more free to be able to say things that maybe other people don't want to hear. So business results first, opportunity team second, and then we look at what actually works in the company. So many companies look at what fails, what's not working. It's important to ground yourself in actually what has worked over the years. We call it success DNA. Mm. So we develop a success profile, and we look at what are the 5 most successful endeavors or projects that you've done in the last few years. And once we've got the 5, then we identify what are the conditions that existed inside the company with success number 1, and what are the conditions that existed outside the company. Then we go to success number 2, success number 3, 4, and 5, and then we start to see a pattern. And then we say, what is the biggest failure that happened in your company in the last few years? And when they tell us that, that's the aha moment, Sean, where people say, oh my goodness, we fail when we go off our success pattern.
Wow.
Right. So you may have remember back in 2011 when Steve Jobs passed away. On his deathbed, he said, I want to make sure that Apple does anything it can to hurt Google. Anytime you have a chance to hurt Google. So what happened in 2012, soon after he passed away, Apple decided it was going to kick Google Maps off of the iPhone and have their own GPS map, which was called, I think, iMaps or something like that, Apple Maps. It was terrible, and people hated it. So what was Apple's success DNA was design something to be perfect, design it to be beautiful, elegant, simple to use, and has what customers want, and don't release it until it's fully ready and has all those qualifications. Well, Apple Maps was not perfect. It was not beautiful. It was not very functional. Customers didn't want it. And it created a public relations nightmare for Apple. Within a short period of time, they put Google Maps back on the iPhone. They fired the head of that division of the company, and they apologized. They went off of their success DNA out of greed, out of revenge, out of competition. It didn't work. So the lesson is know your success DNA and continually leverage it and improve it, right? So step 1, business results. Step 2, opportunity team. Step 3, success DNA. Step 4 is map the resources of your company like an ecosystem. create a what we call a visual resource map of the key people.
Okay.
Broken down by connectors, experts, and accelerators. Map the organizations that are key to your company's growth. And those organizations could be investing companies that invest in you. It could be universities that you're affiliated with. It could be key strategic clients or customers. Any companies that are key to your success. Then map the five markets that you're most focused on, sources of capital, where your money comes from, which could be shareholders, angel investors, banks, the Small Business Administration, friends and family, you know, what have you. Then we map knowledge, which is proprietary knowledge, things that are trademarked and copyrighted, or just knowledge that the company has of what they do well, you know, institutional knowledge, institutional history. And then finally, how you communicate, map your communication, which is website, social media, email, public relations, word of mouth, and all of that. And when you see those categories of your ecosystem on a physical map, or on a digital map, I should say, you start to see you have far more resources than you ever imagined.
Yeah.
I use an algorithm from LinkedIn. LinkedIn, somewhere in your profile, has it'll tell you how many people are connected to you, 3 degrees of separation from you. So let's say you are a pretty significant user of LinkedIn. You have 1,500 direct connections. How many people do you think you could reach 3 degrees of separation from you with 1,500 direct connections? So in other words, you send out an email to your 1,500 people. You ask those 1,500 people to send it out to their first contacts, and then their contacts, and their contacts. So 3 degrees of separation from you. Just take a guess. How many people do you think you could reach?
I'm not sure. Maybe 15,000?
It's more like 15 million.
Wow. My gosh.
So that's what they call the network effect. Right? So if you understand that 3 degrees of separation from a person that is, you know, pretty socially active, that has a network, every client, every customer, every investor, every employee, every new technology, every new product is all 3 degrees of separation from one individual.
Wow.
Which is really the concept of abundance. When you think about the way we think about the world for many, many years, for hundreds of years, is scarcity.
Right.
Right. Hunters and gatherers were competing for a small amount of food. Right. Even agricultural society, a limited amount of land. And then the Industrial Revolution, wealth was created by finite resources, land, oil, gold, steel, minerals, all limited. But now, in the last few decades, when wealth is created now by infinite resources, which is technology, innovation, collaboration, networks. Right? So you look at Netflix, which has a massive market cap, right? It's one of the leading content providers, entertainment companies in the world. They did not use finite resources, right? They didn't build it because they didn't have land was not their major strategic advantage. It was really information,
yeah,
innovation, using that information and getting customers what they wanted and having great collaborations with directors and producers and actors and the people who make films and TV shows and documentaries and so forth. Right?
Yeah.
Look at Amazon, right? Amazon certainly has physical assets, but most of their growth has come through, again, the use of data and giving customers what they want and continually asking, what can we do better for our customers? Right? So once you understand that we are now in a world of abundance, now that abundance is not necessarily shared equally with everybody. We have a lot of people who have zero abundance, but as a society, we have access this abundance, but our minds are still thinking in finite terms, in scarcity. Once we open up our minds through our resource mapping, what we call unlock your network, which is part of culture of opportunity, we start to unlock the mindset that comes with abundance and seeing all your assets on a map in the Unlock Your Network program starts to get people to really truly understand that they have far more resources than they ever imagined that they had. So we did business results, right, was the first step. Second step was assemble your opportunity team.
Right.
The third step was identify your success DNA. The fourth step was to unlock your network by mapping the resources of your network. The next step is creating what we call your year of opportunity. If you had the best year ever, this is what we ask our clients, and you could do whatever you wanted to do, no limitations, blue sky, total realizing your potential, best year ever, what would that year look like? What opportunities would you create in that next year? So we have all of the people in your opportunity team, up to 10 people, do this exercise, and then we start identifying the opportunities that are part of your year of opportunity. Well, Sean, tremendous number of opportunities come up, 20, 30, 40. Well, you can't do all of them. You can only do a small number in one quarter or one year. So then we have a filter, opportunity filter, right? We take opportunity number one. We ask four questions. Will it bring you the business results you're committed to in the time that you needed to? If it's a yes, we go down to the next. Is it consistent with your success DNA? Based on what works in your company, is this opportunity likely to work? Right? Mm. Third question is, do we have the resources to actually fulfill this opportunity? Which we should know from our resource map in your Unlock Your Network program.
Right.
And then finally, is your team on board? So what's unique about the culture of opportunity is it's not one CEO, one owner making that final decision. It's the CEO and the owner allowing these 6 to 10 people in the opportunity team to have a vote. Of course, if you're the owner or the CEO, you can veto that vote. But if you really believe in collaboration, you're going to do this collaboratively, get a consensus. So then out of all these opportunities that come up in the year of opportunity, maybe 25, well, we filter them down to, let's say, 3 or 4 that you want to work on now, right? That go through yes answers to those four questions.
Yeah, okay.
The other ones either go into the parking lot, like they've made the cut, but they're not the top priority. They're not the things that we have to do now, but we should look at them in the near future. And then there's those that we just shouldn't do at all because they're just not consistent with our business results or success DNA. We don't have the resources to do them or what have you, right?
Yeah.
So now you've got this year of opportunity is now translated to, let's say, 4 key opportunities. We put them into an action plan, which we call an opportunity plan, and then we start launching these opportunities and creating goals, objectives, milestones, and who is going to own these different opportunities. So it's like a strategic action plan. And then the opportunity team meets, let's say, once a quarter to review progress and to ensure that these opportunities are moving forward. If there are any obstacles, how can we help remove these obstacles so there's momentum on all these different opportunities or initiatives?
Awesome. I love that. I love that idea of the opportunity plan and kind of developing that strategic action plan for these businesses. That's incredible advice. Now, we've experienced a lot of different crises this year as a country and as a planet. So from the pandemic to the resulting financial crisis that comes with that, also mass unemployment, social unrest, and then even a turbulent wildfire season happening on the West Coast. What advice can you offer conscious business leaders and entrepreneurs right now who are trying to stay resilient during these disruptive times? What would you say to that person to say, these are the steps that you would take to stay profitable and continue to grow a conscious business despite a lot of economic turmoil, social unrest, and uncertainty?
Well, Sean, the first step is to quiet our minds. Mm. There's so much fear. There's so much information, sometimes misinformation, that our minds get so busy with chatter and with anxiety and fear and confusion that we need to have a quiet mind. In my book, Culture of Opportunity, I call it the quiet mind of the conscious leader. And that happens through, at least for me, it happens through meditation. It happens through exercise. I am a cyclist, so I bike through New York City
nice.
Every day. I get out on the bike and, just get out in nature. I try to ride to nature. I went to Governor's Island, which is a beautiful island that used to be owned by the Coast Guard, and now it is a national park. It's right across the river from downtown Manhattan, in right between Manhattan and Brooklyn. So I just quieted the mind in a very peaceful way. So meditation, exercise, yoga, getting out in nature, talking very intimately with your friends like we do in, you know, Share Lab and Opportunity Community is the first step. With a quiet mind, you can work through some of these things. If your mind is constantly busy and you're in a state of anxiety, it's impossible.
Right. Now, you mentioned a couple of different types of meditation in your book. I was wondering which type of meditation that you use regularly.
You know, I use transcendental meditation, but it really doesn't matter. Whatever works for a person, it's turning off the phone, turn off the computer, closing your eyes, putting on some eye shades, and just being quiet for that period of time. Some people use guided meditation, some people use silence, some people use breathing, some people use a mantra. Whatever works, it's more about the consistency. It's more about doing it every day, preferably twice a day. And in the second session, the evening, I often do it late afternoon or early evening. I get a boost of energy, and I get a much, much higher quality evening or afternoon than I would if I didn't do it. It's basically, you know, like for those basketball fans, you know, it's like the coach calls a timeout when your team is behind and a bit frazzled. Everybody gets off to the sidelines, takes a knee, quiets down, and says, all right, let's regroup. Meditation is essentially regrouping the mind and quieting to be able to settle in and then have a much more calm and focused next period of time.
I love that. I love that. Those are some very valuable tips. And that's some incredible advice. Now I wanted to talk about the personal events that have shaped your life and your career. I really want to dive into what has made you the empathetic, compassionate, and generous person that you are. Your work is based on conscious business growth, so I want to explore what got you to that place by talking about your earlier years in your career. Can you first bring me back to your childhood? Can you tell me about your parents? What lessons did they instill in you as a kid? And what values were important to you growing up?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. That's a great question. You know, my parents were both social activists. They were both entrepreneurs in their own unique ways, and they both suffered an enormous amount of adversity that made them who they are and made them want to eliminate or reduce the adversity that other people had to face. So my father was born in Brooklyn, Brownsville, in 1909. And this is a time when there were very few cars. You know, the Model T just came out just, I think, 6 years before that. The subway was just built in 1903. So when my father walked out the door of his tenement building, there were horses and a lot of manure from those horses and you know, just a lot of activity of immigrants. You know, 2 million Jews had emigrated from Eastern Europe between 1880 and 1920, and then you had the immigration of the Germans before that, and then the Irish and the potato famine and the Italians and African Americans coming up after the Civil War. So it was a melting pot of people striving to, you know, follow the American dream. So my father's dream was to get out of poverty by becoming a doctor. And that was his intent, and he was a straight-A student in high school, straight-A student in college, and lo and behold, he found out that there was a Jewish quota, that there was a fear that Jews were going to take over the world and a lot of discrimination against Jews, and so only 3% of doctors could be Jewish. So you have to have political connections in order to be among that 3%. So my father did not. And so he decided, well, I am not giving up on this dream, so I am going to go to Europe and study in Austria at the University of Vienna. So we took a boat 3 weeks across the Atlantic Ocean, began his studies. Now imagine taking medical school education in another language. It's hard enough in your own language.
Yeah.
He happened to know German. He was fluent in German. He took German in high school, college. His parents spoke Yiddish, which is a kind of a dialect which has a lot of German in it. And he did very well. Then in 1938, Hitler invaded Austria, and he was told by the American embassy, you have to go back to the United States. Well, he was a year away from his degree, and he said, I'm not going back. So he got on the train, and he went to Basel, Switzerland, and he finished his medical education in Basel, got his degree, and came back to the United States in 1939, and he became an intern. Back in those days, interns started their career riding in ambulances. There was no such thing as an EMT, no such thing as a physician's assistant. If you're an ambulance, there was a driver and a doctor in that ambulance, and that's wow. That's how he started his career. My mother was born in 1923 in Germany, and she grew up as Hitler came to power in 1933 when she was 10. And then Hitler took over and stole my grandfather's business, had a successful artist brush business in Germany, and they escaped the United States just at the very last minute, surviving the death camps in 1938. So the same year my father was escaping from Austria to Switzerland, my mother was escaping from Germany to the United States. And so she grew up in Brooklyn as well, and she went to Hunter College. Very few women went to college back then, but she was one of those. And she started her career as a writer and then a painter. And then when she had me in 1953, she kind of put her career on hold, and later on went back to a career. And in her second marriage, she actually started a winery. And she and her second husband, my stepfather, were winemakers in California. And they had a very successful winery called Domaine Laurier, which was in the Jimmy Carter White House in American Airlines first class and won a lot of different awards. And then lo and behold, after 10 years, my stepfather had a stroke and died suddenly. So my mother found herself with a business that was manufacturing 22,000 cases of fine wine that she was not interested in managing by herself. So she sold the winery to Kendall Jackson, which is a very famous wine company in California, and was able to go back to her art career later in life.
Wow. Wow, that's an amazing story on so many levels, Mark. Not only does it say so much about you as a person and how your family came from kind of a healing background and also with an artistic side, it kind of reminds me a little bit of my own background because I have a few different doctors in my family as well on my mom's side, and then a few artists in my family as well, photographers mostly. But yeah, thank you for sharing that story. It does tell us a little bit more about yourself. And I understand that you were an adjunct professor and you taught social work and counseling at Columbia University and the University of New Rochelle. I was wondering, what impact did this experience have on your career, and what were some of the highlights from working with students?
Well, you know, I think we glamorize the life of a student because we who are graduates, who graduated university, remember fondly, and we wish that we had the freedom to be able to study what we wanted and learn and not have to just go to work every day and have the demands of working. But I really understood through my own years as a student how difficult it is for most students. I mean, we're not really aware. The average student has to have a job, right?
Yeah.
I mean, most students have to have one or two jobs. When I was in college, I had to have a job. I was working, you know, probably 20 hours a week in my uncle's toy distributorship in Brooklyn in order to be able to afford tuition and, you know, room and board and all of that. So I think it was really helpful for me to understand the life of a student, how students learn best, and the diversity of students. At the College of New Rochelle, I taught adults who were returning to school who were anywhere from 30 to 70. These were people who had not gone directly from high school to college. They had careers mostly as clergy. These were ministers, reverends.
Wow.
They were pastors. They were rabbis. This was at the New York Theological Seminary, was the campus that I taught at. And I really enjoyed working with adult students who had a lot of life experience. And when you're teaching social work and counseling, psychology, which is what I taught, life experience is key. So I really advise people who are in the helping professions to get out as soon as you possibly can, even if it's in high school, get an internship in some form where you're helping or supporting somebody who's helping. So actually you could learn about these concepts in the doing of them, not just in the conceptual framework of them.
Yeah. I love that. I love that concept. And since you mentioned theology, do you have any religious or spiritual practices that have enhanced your daily life? If so, what are they?
Well, I am born Jewish, and so I have a very significant affiliation with my Jewish tradition. Today is the last day of Rosh Hashanah and the beginning of what's called the Days of Awe, the Days of Repentance between the Jewish New Year and Yom Kippur. So I am certainly very appreciative of my Jewish tradition. I also have learned a lot about the Eastern philosophy, Eastern spiritual traditions, Buddhism, Taoism, Hinduism, in travels to India and Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam. So I think my spiritual tradition is very, very eclectic. It's really focuses on the reverence for life, that we have to respect all living things, not just humans, but animals, the plant world, the planet. And I think we have not respected all living things. I think we've exploited a lot of our planet and exploited a lot of the people on our planet for profit without understanding that this is not a sustainable way of doing business in the world. So a lot of the book talks about, you know, how to create a model of business that deeply cares about customers, employees, and the communities that we do business in, and not take from the planet, but rather have some sort of a sustainable way of working with the resource that you have, rather than, you know, taking them and then making a lot of money and then giving back to charity after you've, you know, destroyed things on the planet or exploited people or what have you.
I love that concept of kind of taking care of the planet and giving more back to it than we got from it. So that's amazing. I know that you have a background working with companies traumatized by 9/11. Can you talk about what it was like to witness that and what lessons you learned that you can pass along to our listeners?
Yes, be happy to, Sean. So the Share Lab, actually an opportunity community, really has its origins in 9/11. So our offices, when the company was called Perform Excellence, were on Broadway and 21st Street. And I saw both towers go down when I was looking down Broadway from the waiting room of my office. And that was the most horrific thing I'd seen in my business career, to see the towers actually implode from, you know, just, I was probably a mile and a half away. It was just devastating. So I went home back to Riverdale when I was living at the time and was desperately calling up the New York Police Department, the Fire Department, the Red Cross, Salvation Army, trying to find some way to volunteer. And there was thousands, tens of thousands of people wanted to volunteer. There just wasn't a proper setup for that. So luckily that Friday after September 11th, I got a call from an employee assistance program, the employee resource group in Chicago that had two clients that were in the World Trade Center, one of which was a company called Eurobrokers that lost 62 people in the Trade Center when the second plane hit the second tower and actually sliced it in half and destroyed their offices on the 81st floor. So I witnessed the first great miracle of my career when I walked into One New York Plaza, a half a mile from Ground Zero, where the Prudential Securities had given Eurobrokers a free trading floor that was not being used by them at the time to restart their company. And so the whole idea of Success DNA was the C-suite executives, the CEO, CFO, COO, general counsel, were all focused on keeping the company alive, working with the insurance companies, working with the families, working with the media, working with their clients to keep them alive. And the second tier and third tier of managers figured out on their own how to set up the physical structure of the company, where to put the monitors, the TVs, the trading desks, the furniture, and where people would sit and how the whole thing would be organized, how the software would be redeveloped. Some of that code was lost. So I ran a team of people who were charged with helping people psychologically, you know, survive this. And we developed a way to use critical incident stress debriefing, which was a program that was developed by a firefighter in Baltimore. I believe his name was Dennis Mitchell back in the 90s. And we did these critical incident stress debriefing workshops, starting with the senior executives and then through all of the trading desks and all the support units of the company. And we started with this with the senior management first because we wanted to, them to be an example that it's okay to share your feelings about the trauma. And we asked questions in a way similar to what we do in ShareLab. It was obviously related specifically to the 9/11 tragedy. And we also realized that in order to keep people together, and this was together now in a physical place because it wasn't a pandemic that kept people apart, it was more the trauma, the company said anybody who wants to come back can come back, and anybody who wants to stay home will pay you 100% of your salary, come back whenever you want to, however you want to, in for whatever length of time you want to. So because they gave permission to people to go at their own pace, people actually wanted to come back. We had 96% of the employees of Eurobrokers came back within the first 3 months. We ran these programs through the end of the year, and the company was profitable in the fourth quarter. They raised $3 million of that profit for the Eurobrokers Memorial Fund to help out the surviving families of the people that they lost. So I learned about the importance of connecting to the head and the heart, and keeping people together by allowing them to express their feelings and support one another.
Wow. Wow, that's an incredible story. And I was wondering if you can take me on a journey on how one goes about finding their purpose. How would you define purpose? And maybe for those who are struggling right now, or they're in maybe perhaps in an earlier part of their career, what tips would you offer to them to help them uncover their purpose in life?
Well, you know, Sean, there's some people who know their purpose very early and they're very clear about it. There are other people it takes a much longer time. The first thing I would say is don't judge yourself, don't criticize yourself if you're not clear on your purpose at whatever point in time you're at right now. I think the question that I suggest people ask is not what is my purpose, which is a bit of a vague, you know, abstract question. It is how can I best serve humanity or any particular part of humanity with the gifts that I have been given. What is the impact? What is the biggest impact I can have by offering the gifts that I have, whether those be, you know, strategy, analytics, marketing, accounting, English proficiency, you know, whatever your gifts. Everybody has probably far more gifts than they're even recognizing. But what is the best impact I can get? I can have with the gifts that I've been given, and then go out and use those gifts to help somebody, and then in the doing of it, you'll discover what you like to do, what's having the most impact, and I believe through life experience, you know, your purpose will come.
I love that. Can you remember a time that something weird or unexpected happened to you on your leadership journey? And what did you learn from that experience?
Well, weird and unexpected, certainly when my wife and I first got married in 1979 and we bought our first home in 1981. And 6 days after we moved into our home in Brooklyn, somebody threw kerosene underneath the back door, lit a match, and tried to burn the house down. So it was an arson fire. And then very soon after, we had boarded up the house, within the next couple of weeks, vandals came in and stole 4 hand-carved fireplace mantles, stained glass windows, and then finally took my bicycle, microwave, and TV. So we moved back in the house with no heat, no hot water, no electricity, no alarm system, and no kitchen. And what I learned is that no matter how rich you might be, and we were certainly not rich, we were, you know, kind of just struggling newlyweds, but, you know, we had possessions, we had a house. You really don't have anything permanent except for what's in your heart and in the world of the people who care about you. So even though we lost our physical home, or almost lost, I mean, the structure was still there, but a lot of our possessions were burnt out of existence. I really let go of my, as much as I possibly could, my attachment to physical things, my attachment to identity. I mean, I had to give up my job to basically, you know, do the contracting and reconstruction of this home. And I realized that the generosity of my family, my wife's family, and just the community, people that didn't even know us. I mean, we were only in this house 6 days before this fire. people I'd ever met came by and offered food. They offered where to find plumbing. Mm. One of them even offered us one guy even came and offered us a guard dog to help us guard the house. it was just an incredible outpouring of generosity and help. We had my wife's brother moved in to live with us. One of my friends moved in to help us reconstruct the house. So it was really learning about what's important in life and that you can survive just about any adversity if you have the confidence in yourself, you stay together, you communicate, you collaborate, and you give and receive love as well as all the other things that come with survival, you know, such as, you know, banging nails into walls and, you know, painting and scraping and, you know, all the things that have to do with getting a house that's been almost burnt to the ground back to life.
Wow. Yeah, you've been through some tragic things, some amazing disruptions, amazing and obviously not a good way, but you've experienced so many throughout your personal and professional life, and from the arson to 9/11, the theft from your business, the recession, and even now the pandemic. What do you think is the biggest challenge or disruption that you've ever had to overcome out of all of those?
Well, I would say, Sean, they are amazing in a good way. I don't, you know, I don't look at them as bad things. They're just things that happen to me. Mm-hmm. I don't think I am particularly unique. I mean, there are 2 billion people on the planet who wake up every morning not knowing if they're going to have enough food to eat.
Right.
You know, we have an enormous number of homeless people. We've got, I think, 2 million Americans are in jail. So I don't think my adversity is so extreme. So I think if there are things that happened to me, I thought they were happening to me, but I realized they happened for me. Hmm. You know, there are things that I could learn. So I think it's a mindset of the way you deal with it, with adversity. So as the question was, what's the greatest adversity that's happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I can't really put them in competition with one another. I certainly, the fire was a tremendous adversity. I think 9/11 and what happened in my business was a great adversity. Certainly this pandemic, I think, has been extremely difficult because, you know, you can't physically be with the people you love, mm-hmm. or at least not with many of them, maybe with some of them, but it's very, you know, it's limited what you can do. But it's also been an incredibly beautiful time to connect with people that I've not seen in a long time and help people in a way that maybe I didn't even realize we could help them.
Yeah. Through technology now too. So that's amazing. Now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and dive into the rapid fire questions. So are you ready for those?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Awesome. First question, where did you grow up and where do you live now?
Grew up in Forest Hills, Queens, not too far from Citi Field. And I live right now in Hell's Kitchen, right on the southern end of Hell's Kitchen on 42nd Street and 12th Avenue, right next to the Hudson River.
Awesome. Do you have a favorite quote, and what is it, and who is it by?
Well, I guess I've got a lot of favorite quotes, but the one that's short and sweet and people will remember is Mike Tyson said, "Everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face."
That's great.
So it's planning is good, but you know what? You know, plans are plans, and there's things that happen like the pandemic, like 9/11, like getting your house burned down, that you have to be resilient and don't think that because you have a plan that plan is necessarily going to stay the same.
Mm. That's a great quote. And a major theme of our show is on compassion and altruism. When is the last time that you did something for somebody else without the expectation of return?
Well, I try to do that every day. You know, the work that we do with our clients, the work that we do with our colleagues. You know, I co-teach with one of my colleagues, Meg Brindle, at the University of Maryland at George Washington University, you know, which is basically pro bono to give the students an added support from our Culture of Opportunity program. So I try to do things without an expectation of return. You know, I mean, sure, obviously we get paid for what we do, but we don't necessarily get paid for how we do it. We try to do it in the best possible way and continually asking ourselves the opportunity lab, how do we serve our clients better, getting feedback from them and using that feedback to continually improve what we do and how we do it.
That's great. And I love that you're always looking for ways of helping others and giving back to community. So that's perfect. Who is one of your biggest heroes, role models, or mentors? And are they alive or dead?
Well, as I mentioned, my parents are, you know, my father became a doctor, and he then became a, once he started as a general practitioner, and then he became a psychiatrist. So his goal in life was to alleviate mental suffering, and he worked with very, very poor patients who paid him little or nothing for many, many, many years. And he worked at an institution called the Linden Hill School, which was a residential treatment center for mostly disturbed kids in Westchester. Wow. And he helped an enormous number of those kids and developed a therapeutic community there with the other administrators. My mother was a social activist, and she developed the first ever exhibition that painted the Holocaust in color. So
wow.
She lost many, many, many relatives in the Holocaust, and she was visited by her ancestors in her sleep, in her dreams, and they said, you know, the Holocaust happened in color. People had lives before, during, and after the Holocaust, those who survived it. And all of the photographs, everything that's depicted in the Holocaust is in black and white. And somebody has got to paint our lives in color. So my mother did an 18 painting series before, during, and after the Holocaust in color, really depicting the lives of people as full human beings, not just as corpses, you know, that died in the ovens. So it was the largest Jewish exhibition in the history of San Francisco at the Herbst Pavilion in the Presidio in Golden Gate Park. And it was called Silent Voices Speak, and it was used to help people understand how we can use the Jewish Holocaust as a teaching tool for social justice, because there are so many other Holocausts that have happened around the world to different types of people. So we had a 10-lecture series. We had Dith Prawn, who wrote The Killing Fields. Harry Wu, who was a Nobel Prize activist from China. Actors Peter Coyote and Ed Asner were some of the moderators. Deborah Lipstadt, famous historian. So my mother was very much of an activist and really helping use her experience escaping the Holocaust to help other people, you know, learn from that experience and help prevent Holocaust around the world.
Amazing, amazing. I wish I could have seen that in person. That sounds amazing. All right. What is a film or documentary that has changed your life or your perspective on life?
Wow. I love films, so there's so many that come to my mind. Well, I would say the two that come to my mind are The Civil War by Ken Burns, you know, which is, I think there's 10 episodes. Really helped me understand how the origins of some of the issues of race that we're dealing with today have not gone away, and the whole history of how the injustice began, and that the Civil War was obviously a point of progress, but it was nowhere near the end of it. So Ken Burns really changed the way documentaries are made. You know, he used music, he used archival footage, he used interviews, in a very different way than it was done before. So I love the work of Ken Burns. I would say Bang the Drum Slowly, which I think was Robert De Niro's third film. You know, it was, I think, 1973. And it's a very small independent film about two baseball players who become best friends. And one of them, the Robert De Niro character, Bruce Pearson was his name, ends up with cancer. And it's about how the Michael Moriarty character, Michael Moriarty was the first DA in Law and Order way back when, he befriends the Robert De Niro character and helps him die in a very beautiful way.
Wow.
And that film is really about compassion and gratitude.
Mm. Yeah.
And healing. So those two films are kind of complimentary in my list of many favorites.
Awesome, awesome. And final rapid fire question: what is your favorite book, and why is it your favorite?
Wow. I would say, and this is a difficult question because I have a lot of favorite books as well. I would say the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, which is the kind of the origin book of Taoism. It's really a book of poetry, and it to me is about the reverence of life and about removing your ego from how you see the world and being really in the flow of humanity and of life. And I go back and read that book multiple times over the years.
Beautiful, beautiful. I love that you incorporate a lot of that Eastern tradition in your work and throughout your life. So that's amazing. All right. So thank you for answering those rapid fire questions. I just have a few more questions before we wrap up the interview. If you could write three words or mantras on a billboard with the intention of helping good people with good intentions make a greater impact, what would those three words be?
All life is reverent. Those are four words. life is reverent. To revere life and not take it for granted, and ensure that we can do everything possible to care for all living things.
Awesome, awesome. Next question. What is your why behind helping others, and why do you love helping?
My why is because in order for me to feel like I have meaning in the world and that I can justify my existence, I think it's every human being's responsibility to do what they can for themselves and for each other. And it's much more enjoyable and meaningful to live that way. I've got much more pleasure and sense of having a good life by being in service to other people and to myself. I don't think of it as sacrifice. I enjoy it tremendously, and I get a lot from it, and people are appreciative. I get a lot done for me. People are very, very generous to me, so I feel very blessed to have that kind of virtuous circle in my life.
I love that. And are there any other nuggets of wisdom, perhaps habits, routines that you practice daily that you'd like to share with the audience?
Just along the lines of, the quiet mind of the conscious leader, I think also getting enough sleep and, realizing that, at some point your body keeps the score, and you got to listen to your body and say, enough. Mm-hmm. You will trust yourself. Or hope you will trust yourself. Tomorrow's another day, and so make sure that you're in this for the long run and not, burning out your mind and your body, because once you get to a certain point, it's very hard to come back from it. People who do not respect their minds and bodies end up with a lot of illness, and once they get to a certain point, it's very hard to recover, and it takes a much longer time. So respect yourself, just as all life is to be revered. That includes us, includes each one of us, to revere us by what we eat, by what we say, by the media that we consume. I do have a media diet. I do not watch or listen to more than 10 minutes of news in the morning and 10 minutes in the afternoon. I do listen to podcasts. I try to keep informed, but in terms of the actual traditional news, I try to keep that to what I need to know and not let my mind be overwhelmed with the fear and confusion that is often out there.
Awesome. I love that, Mark. I'll drop a link to your book, Culture of Opportunity, in the show notes, and I highly encourage listeners to check it out, especially if you enjoyed this episode and you're looking for ways to enhance your leadership toolkit. Final question, what are other ways listeners can stay connected to your work, and can you tell us about a little bit about the Opportunity community and how to get involved?
Well, you can reach us, as I said earlier, at discover@oplab.com. That's OPPLAB.com. We have a couple of free assessments on our website, so you can go to that, which is, again, OPPLAB.com. You can check out my book on Amazon. It's in Kindle as well in print. You can look me up on LinkedIn if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn. As far as Opportunity Community, we're just running one right now. If we may start some more soon. But, just if you're interested in that, drop a note in the discover@oplab.com and tell us you're interested in Opportunity Community.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mark. I just want to acknowledge you for sharing all of this wonderful insight with us today, for the wisdom, the knowledge, the tools and tips that you've gained and passed on to so many extraordinary organizations, but also your genuine compassion, your desire to change the world, to make it a better place for humans, wildlife, and the planet. So I want to thank you again for taking some time out of your very busy day to speak with me. I hope to stay connected and maybe even have you back on the show again someday. So thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome, Sean. Thank you for doing the work you're doing. And I love the show and the concept, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to this episode. Share it with your friends. And please leave us a review and remember to rate us 5 stars if you enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you.